Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the appellant this morning, Eric Klein.
Let me make sure my microphone's on. I wasn't sure. Okay, now it's on. Okay, thanks.
For two reasons, we are requesting that this court vacate the harassment restraining order that was put in place against Mr. Klein. First, the district court prematurely issued its final order 3 days after the referee issued its recommendations and order, which precluded Mr. Klein from requesting judicial review of the recommendations. In other words, once the district court's order was signed and filed, the order became final, and there was no mechanism for Mr. Klein to challenge the referee's recommended findings.
Now, I gather, correct me if I'm wrong, that's sort of the heart of the whole case, your appeal.
That's correct.
What is the basis? I didn't see any citation to any authority for that proposition, in your opinion, that once the district court countersigns the report and recommendation or order, that either party is precluded, as you say, from seeking review. What's the basis of that?
The basis is in 44.70, which states that it becomes the court's order once it's signed. So once that's a final order, there's no more recommendation that can be reviewed.
Okay, so if I read the statute correctly, and I believe I have, the statute says all orders and findings recommended by the referee become effective when it's countersigned and remain effective during the pendency of review. And it says further that including a remand to the referee unless the judge, meaning the district court judge, changes the order during the pendency of the review. So why doesn't that implicitly defeat your proposition that the order is no longer reviewable after the judge signs it?
Yeah, a couple things. First, within the HRO statute, it states that when the referee signs the HRO, it is effective from that point forward. So it's a little bit different than the referee statute, where it is effective from the point the referee signs it. However, when it's effective, that doesn't mean it's a final order. Right. So during that period, when it's effective, that means it can be in place, especially in these HRO situations where during this review period, we want the person who's supposed to be protected to be protected while it's under review. And I read effective as different than final order of the court.
Well, see, the problem with that argument, I think, is both statutes, the HRO statute and the referee statute, refers to effective orders. All orders and findings recommended by a referee become effective, an effective order when countersigned. So that effective order can be reviewed. And why would it matter whether it's effective because the referee signs it or it's effective because the district court countersigns it? If there's a provision for review and an understanding that the order, the effective order, can be changed during the review period.
So I read that portion of the referee statute to mean, so you have the referee signs the recommendations during that 10-day period. If during that 10-day period somebody challenges it and files a request for challenging it, at that point the court under the referee statute can sign it during that period and it is effective during that period.
But
I read it as if there is a challenge while that review is going on, the court can sign it, and it is effective during that time period while while the challenge is going on, while the review is going on.
You've got to add quite a bit of language to reach that interpretation.
Well, I think it's a reasonable interpretation of the statute. I mean, otherwise, if there's a final order, there's nothing that says you can challenge or request review of a final order.
Distinction and where do you read final order into a statute that does not say final order?
Subdivision 7C, the recommended findings and order of a referee become the findings and orders of the court when confirmed by the judge. That is different than effective in the way I read it. The difference between the language in C and E, because C doesn't say effective. And I read an order of the court being different than just an effective order.
Well, didn't the district court?
You have to read C and E together. So C talks about the recommended findings and orders of the referee become the findings and orders of the court when confirmed by a judge. And then
I read C.
And then E goes on to say all orders and findings recommended by a referee become an effective order when countersigned by the judge. So aren't C and E talking about the same things, confirming by countersigning by a judge?
I don't, because we have D in between C and E, and that's where we're talking about the review. So under C, when a judge signs it, it becomes the order of the court. Then D allows for somebody to challenge the how the process would work for someone to challenge the referee's recommendations.
And then there's a separate confirming by countersigning?
Say it again?
And then there's a separate countersigning?
So
what happens, what happens in C to demonstrate the confirmation? How does a judge, district court judge, confirm?
By signing the order.
Okay, so how does, okay, then read E. All orders and findings become effective when countersigned by the judge. Are you saying there's a difference between signing and countersigning?
I believe because of D and the fact that E talks about during the review process.
No, my question is there a difference between signing and countersigning?
You know, I looked into that. There has to be some difference because they use it differently in the statute. I read it. C talks about the judge
confirming. Isn't countersigning confirming? Because there's two signature blocks, right? One for the referee and one for the judge.
So I've in the criminal context, I've reviewed a lot of HRO cases. A lot of the court orders I have reviewed have been actual written orders of findings of why the HR, why their support for the HRO. I have not seen an HRO signed by a judge that's used later on that is just a signature on this form order.
On the HRO at issue here, there's two signature blocks, correct?
That's correct.
So there's a signature by the referee and then another signature by the judge.
That's correct.
And you agree the signature by the judge is a countersigning?
Yes.
So when did the order become effective?
3 days after the referee signed it.
So the referee signed it, that made it effective, but then you have this statute that says it becomes effective when the district court judge signs it.
I will admit it's not the best statute, that's why we're discussing this, but
I think that's a little clumsy, but I don't know that it really matters. I mean, the fact that one statute says it's effective when the referee signs it, the other statute says it's effective when the district court judge signs it. Either way, after indicating that we're talking about an order, because now it's an effective order, we have a review process that seems to be viable and alive during or after that order has become effective. So your argument seems to be that if I read your brief correctly, that the district court is prohibited from countersigning until 10 days go by. And that, I think, is that requires a lot of extra wording for us to build into the statute. And of course, you know, the case law is pretty clear on prohibiting courts from adding to statutes. Mm-hmm. So how do we get to that part of your argument, that the district court is bound to wait 10 days after receiving the referee's conclusions?
Right, and I agree. It's not crystal clear in the statute, but our reading of it is...
When you say it's not crystal clear...
It's not crystal clear.
I'm not looking for... Is it even remotely...
I'm saying either way, clear? It's not crystal clear. When a judge signs a... there's nothing in the statute that says somebody can challenge the judge's order in the referee.
Isn't that an appeal process to challenge the judge's order? This statute is, as it relates to the effectiveness of a referee's decision, and the referee's decision doesn't become a final order of the court until a district court judge signs it. So your argument that there's nothing to challenge the judge's signature, isn't that what you're doing here today by appealing this matter?
So I agree with you, and that's my whole point, is if a judge signs the order within the 10-day period, then the individual cannot challenge the recommendations.
But then doesn't that make the language of E superfluous, such that it indicates and remains effective during the pendency of the review? And again, another principle is that legislature wouldn't put language in a statute that is unnecessary. So you're saying that you cannot challenge order once a judge has signed it, doesn't that make that language, quite frankly, useless?
No, because I read that language as once there has been a request for a review, the judge can sign it, and it's effective during the review period. And then during that review period, sorry, I was distracted.
Just pause for 1 second. Yep. I think your mute button is on, I think. There you go. Thanks.
Thank you.
So during that period where there is a review, that order can be effective if the judge wants it to be in place while there's a review. That's how I read that portion of the statute.
So, counsel, let's just go through a hypothetical, because one issue or one area in which this comes up would be an OFP.
Yep.
When you have a temporary OFP, once you have a trial, that temporary OFP goes away. So are you saying in this 10-day period in which there's no longer a temporary order and a judge cannot sign an order, you have a 10-day free period where even if a court found that there was enough to have an OFP, a judge cannot confirm it, and in essence, the respondent gets the ability to have 10 days where there's no OFP in place.
Right, so I'm not sure what the OFP statute says about that, but the HRO statute has a provision that says it's effective at the time the referee signs it. So during that 10-day period...
It doesn't say final, it says effective.
That's right.
Isn't that consistent with the idea that it becomes effective under subdivision, or the language in subdivision 7E, that all orders and findings recommended by a referee become effective when countersigned by a judge and remain effective during the pendency of a review?
Yes, during the review period, an order can be effective, but I don't believe that that is the final order, because during the review period, the judge could say, I am going to vacate this, and they can vacate the order because it's not final. That effective language means it's effective, it's in place, but it can still be vacated or reversed by the district court judge because it's not final.
And I guess it comes back to my question, therefore what? Why can't the judge vacate the order after signing the order?
Because if there hasn't been a review before the judge signs the order, then it's over. But
you keep saying that. I'm looking for something to grab onto implicitly in the statute to support that conclusion. It seems to me there's a few legal premises that you're basing your argument on. One, that the district court is precluded from countersigning until 10 days have lapsed. And two, that the district court, once the district court signs the countersigns the recommendation and it becomes an effective order, that there can be no challenge to it.
So you're saying becomes an effective order. I'm talking about the difference between the order of the court, the final order, and an effective order are two different things in my mind. The effective order is when it goes into effect during the review process. When it's only in effect and not a final order, it can be reversed.
I'm going to ask you another question, but because your time is up, I'll let it percolate, and you can answer when you come up for your rebuttal, which is this issue even ripe for our review if your client did not actually seek review? And you can, I know you've got some argument in your reply brief about that, but why don't you hold on to that idea and you can come out charging. When
all right, sounds good.
You can come up for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Stephen R. Little. I am the attorney for respondent Sandra K. Brown. I think the court understands what the issue is here today. Does Minnesota Statute 474.70 subdivision 7D require the district court to wait 10 days before adopting the referee's recommendations?
But before you get into that, you didn't phrase it that way in your brief, the way I have suggested the phrasing of it, which is ripeness. Is the issue ripe for us to review in light of the, if it turns out that we do not interpret the hearing request of the appellant as a review request?
Right, I agree, I don't think it is. It's undisputed that the appellant never filed a motion for judicial review under 474.70. Instead, he filed a request. He filed a request for hearing under Minnesota Statute 609.748, which was the improper
Counselor,
request.
At that point, appellant was representing himself. He didn't have an attorney. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And at that point, the judge had signed the referee's order. At the time he filed this request for a hearing, the judge had already signed the order, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So given that self-represented people are given some leeway by the courts, why isn't it appropriate, given the facts before us, to interpret this as a request for review by the district court? Clearly, at that point, there had already been a hearing, and the district court signed the referee's recommendation.
After we received appellant's brief, my office contacted the district court and discovered that the appellant had called the district court on January 12th of 2024, which was still within his 10-day window, and the district court clerk, whoever spoke with him, explained to him it looks like that what he filed was incorrect and gave him the number for legal aid. So it appears that the district court did try to help him correct his error, but the appellant just never filed the request for hearing under 474.70. And so the 10-day window expired on January 16, 2024, which was an extra day because of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. And if the appellant had filed the request for hearing and the district court rejected it because the referee's findings were already signed and it was final, we'd have a different argument, and we'd have a different interpretation of the statute here today, but that's not what happened. The appellant just didn't comply with the statute, and even though he was pro se, it looks like the district court tried to help him, and he could have contacted legal aid, or he could have contacted an attorney within those 10 days, but he just never did. And The public policy here supports the appellant's position that these, you know, harassment restraining orders are when people don't get along. And here they live next to each other. And in appellant's brief, he points out, and in the record, Ms. Brown was very concerned about her safety. There was gunshots. The appellant's walking around his property with a gun. And there's, you know, multiple police reports. These people do not get along, and there's been a lot of problems up until the restraining order was issued. And so the 10-day window for the losing party, the restraining order is effective, and it's in place. And the losing party then has a 10-day window to ask judicial review. This court recently rejected appellant's argument in Colburn versus Gentiva. In that case, this court said that the statute does not require that the district court wait 10 days to approve the referee's recommendations, but rather that the losing party has that 10-day window. So even if...
And that was a non-presidential case, wasn't it?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is, but it's the same exact issue here.
What do you make of the interplay between 609-748, subdivision 5, this reference to the HRO becoming effective upon the referee signature, and then... in the referee statute, 44.70, an order becoming effective upon the countersigning of the district court judge.
Yeah, that is an interesting question. But I think that the 609-748 subdivision 5 is the one that the court should focus on because of the public policy issues, because of the seriousness of restraining orders, and because of the safety of the person seeking the restraining order, that it should become effective, and that the party that's seeking it shouldn't have to wait 10 days after the hearing and after the referee's recommendations for the restraining order to be effective. And the statute does give the losing party that the restraining order is issued against a 10-day window to seek judicial review, where they can have another hearing, and if there's any error in the referee's findings or recommendations, the district court could change them or even vacate the restraining order. But that just didn't happen here. And so if this court is going to issue a decision saying that now district court judges have to wait 10 days before adopting the referee's recommendations, it's going to cause a lot of problems throughout the district courts in the state of Minnesota. And it is also going to affect victims of harassment. And so if the court was inclined to adopt appellant's position, I believe that it is going to be a very big deal statewide, and it would have, I think it would have to be appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court to determine whether or not that is the actual law, given that this court recently ruled that it wasn't in Colburn in a 2022 non-precedential opinion. So I think the Minnesota Supreme Court would have to decide this issue.
Are you saying we can't decide the issue?
No, I'm saying you can decide the issue, but now we're going to have two very different, opposite decisions from this court that I think would have to be reconciled by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And I realize that Colburn was non-presidential, and this decision may be non-presidential as well.
Should it
be? But it's going to cause a lot of... I'm not saying it should not be presidential. I think it should. I think this is a very important decision for parties seeking restraining orders and the attorneys that practice in this field. we would like certainty and know whether or not that, you know, we need to have the district court wait 10 days.
Do you think that...
If we were to issue a precedential opinion, what would the syllabus point, what would you recommend the syllabus point be?
I don't know, Your Honor. I have had about 15 appeals in my career, my 25 career, and so could you clarify what you want the syllabus point to be?
What would be the legal standard that you would be asking us to adopt for the point of law?
That the statute provides that a party has 10 days to seek judicial review under 47470, but that the district court does not have to wait 10 days to adopt the referee's recommendations, which is what this court ruled in Colburn. I think that is the correct decision, and I think that's what the law is, and I think it is what this court should confirm in ruling on this case.
Thank you.
Does it matter in our analysis whether, or how does it matter, this interplay between the HRO becoming effective upon the signing by the referee and this language in the referee statute that the referee's orders and findings recommended by the referee become effective when countersigned by the judge? How does it affect the timing, and how does it affect the right to seek review?
That's a very good question, and I think that Your Honor makes a good point that it is confusing. And again, I come back to the request for judicial review statute, that in the case of harassment restraining orders, unlike, let's say, a housing court decision on an eviction, the law should be that the restraining order becomes effective upon the referee's recommendations, pending the 10-day window for the losing party to request judicial review under 484.70. Otherwise, it would make the language in 47470 kind of superfluous. I have a hard time pronouncing that word.
We know what you mean.
You know what I mean. And again, it's because of the nature of a restraining order and because of the urgency of these being effective. If a referee finds that there is danger and that a restraining order needs to be put in place for the safety of the party seeking it, it should become effective as soon as possible. And a lot of times when parties file these, it takes weeks to get a hearing, and sometimes months, and in the meantime, the harassment can still be taking place. Usually, these are issued on an ex parte basis, and then there is a ability of a party to have a hearing, and those are usually they try to schedule them pretty quickly. But I recently have one where the restraining order went in place in July, and we're not going to have a hearing until November on it now. And so it goes both ways, too. If an ex parte restraining order is granted on flimsy grounds that really, you know, the party that has the restraining order against them would like to seek it to be vacated, and having to wait this period of time can cause a lot of problems for one, applying for rental, you know, to rent an apartment, to apply for a job, and things like that. So I think it's important that 47470, the referee's findings become effective upon the recommendations.
So and if they become final upon...
Not become final, become effective, I'm sorry.
When the referee signs it.
Right.
Now, Colburn was not an HRO case, and in that case, the order would have become effective only when countersigned by the judge, not when signed by the referee. What is the effect, do you believe, of that difference in the procedural circumstance?
I would have to review Colburn again, but it's still interpreted the 10-day window and the fact that the judge countersigned. Was that an OFP? I can't remember. On the same day, there was still, the court said that the aggrieved party still had the 10-day window to seek judicial review. And so, in other words, even though under the statute, the restraining order of the OFP becomes final upon countersigning, the aggrieved party still has the ability to seek judicial review. And our judicial system is overwhelmed. We have district court judges, but we have to, and especially in a lot of the larger counties, have to appoint referees to handle the caseload, especially in areas like family law and housing court and restraining order cases. And in this case, there was a referee that heard the party's arguments and had a hearing on the 5th and made a determination that there was grounds for a restraining order by Ms. Brown against Mr. Klein. And the district court countersigned it on January 8th.
Sure. Thank you. I think your time has lapsed a bit ago.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just clarify the timeline a little bit here. So on January 5th.
And again, just to state your name for the record.
Oh, sorry, so Anders Erickson on behalf of the
thank
appellant.
You. Yep.
So on January 5th, the referee issued recommendations. At that point, those recommendations became effective. They were in place. If Mr. Klein violated that order, there were consequences. Mm-hmm. The district court did not have to file its own order to make that those recommendations effective. So the only thing that order did on the 8th was make it a final order. Then on the 9th, Mr. Klein requested a hearing. And as Judge Cochran stated, which I agree with, I don't know what a pro se defendant or respondent in this case would do besides file that document.
Well, you know what a lawyer would do. A lawyer would file a request for review.
I mean, with that document, saying it's a request for review of an HRO finding. It's not a request for review of a referee. You know, what the specific request for review of is the HRO, which is under the HRO statute.
Well, the request for review under the referee statute that we're talking about is the review of what the referee signed. It doesn't seem to matter whether it became effective or not, whether we have to wait for effectiveness for the district court to sign it, as in other recommendations by the referee, or in this case, because it's an HRO, it becomes effective upon the referee's signature. Still, you have an order that can be reviewed. So when you say a pro se has, I mean, I appreciate your concern about pro se, but our case law is pretty clear that the rules don't change when an individual is pro se. We don't have a different standard for pro se litigants and represented litigants in our case law. So assume for a moment that we were to hold that the hearing request that your client filed is not a request for review under the referee statute, under 48470. Would this issue then fail on appeal for not being ripe?
No, and that goes back to what our argument was originally, that order was final and nobody could challenge it at that point because there's nothing in the law that allows a challenge of a final district court order in district court. But I want
to. But if you don't attempt to, but if the party doesn't attempt to seek review, on what basis would the party have to say that they were denied the right to seek review?
I think if a district...
On the question of standing and ripeness.
Right. If a district court issues a final order, I don't think anybody has... Let's say the law is extremely clear the law says district courts cannot file an order within 10 days. Let's just assume that that's what the law says. And the judge filed an order on day 5. And nobody filed anything after. That issue would still be ripe on appeal to say the judge violated that law by issuing the order within before the 10-day period lapsed.
But your argument is that there is a such a law.
That's correct.
And that the district court violated the law. So what would be the basis for standing or ripeness that there that you can challenge the notion that there is such a law if you haven't actually, if the party hasn't actually?
Because there's no mechanism to challenge a final order in district court. There's nothing anybody could have filed at that point to say that it was wrong for the district court to do it. That's why we're here now, we're appealing it. But I do want to be clear that a strong part of our argument why this was a final order is that we still have not received an order from the court ruling on Mr. Klein's request on January 9th. We still don't have that. So there's nothing for, this court can't review, there's no order of the district court saying what that was filed under, or if that was a proper filing.
Well, I think there's, I believe one of the parties, I don't know if it was you or Mr. Little, included a record of, actually it's a public record, what's in the district court filing, which is treat that as a, there's a discussion, there's a language about a discussion with the client about that this isn't, it seems as if he thought it was an appeal to this court. As I read the language in the notation for that filing.
A couple responses. First,
yes.
The district court never found that that was an improper filing. There's never been an order after he filed that on January 9th saying that that was an improper filing. So if we had an order where the judge said, this is not reviewable, it wasn't filed under the right statute, it's not a proper request, we would be in a different situation. But the district court still hasn't ruled on that request. And that is strong evidence that that January 5th or the January 8th order was a final order, and the judge did not want to review anything subsequent to that.
What's your position as to whether we should issue, whether our decision in this case should be rendered as a precedential opinion?
I always think it's good for this court to clarify the law. And I do think that the interplay between these two statutes, especially as we've discussed, the HRO statute making it effective at that time and how that conflicts with the referee statute, I think it's important for this court to issue an order in our favor, of course. But if I could just hint
And the rule of law would be what?
The rule of law would be in an HRO case where a referee makes recommendations which become effective on the date of that order, the district court has to wait 10 days before it issues its final order. And if I could just, you mentioned the notes in the record on Mensis. That's not a court finding. We don't know what was said. That was after the fact. That's not part of the record. We can look at it and say, Mr. Klein wanted to challenge something. He wanted to appeal something. But as a pro se litigant who wants to challenge a referee's recommendations, I don't think we can take anything away. There was no district. We still don't have an order from the court on his request.
All right. Well, I cut off Mr. Little, so in fairness to him.
I appreciate it.
I think we're finished. Thank you for your argument,
you.
Both of you. A very interesting issue. First time, I think, before us in this setting anyway. We will issue an opinion within the statutory period. The matter is under advisement. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Have a good day.